episode number 200 with Alexander Fitzgerald. Welcome to the Heads of Poker podcast. This is Steve Barton.
And this is Mike Snyderman.
And we have 200 episodes now. Can you believe it, Mike?
Some people feel that was 199 too many, Steve. I don't know.
Oh, that's great. I guess I kind of always imagined us getting here. I'm already starting to visualize 300, so I have no intention of stopping. But yeah, this has been an awesome run, man. We've had some hell of a line of guests, huh?
Yeah, I don't know if I could even. All I remember is I did a lot of moaning, Steve. The first 199 episodes, but from here forward, it's going to be Mike 2.0. I'm just you'll hear nothing of my personal life. People don't want to hear that. I promise.
I think that's what keeps them coming back. But
I wonder. We've developed some friends through this. Not just had some guests. I think we've developed some friendship through this this show too, huh, Steve?
We have. This has just really been this has been an awesome experience. It's brought me into contact with the fans and with poker players that I otherwise never would have had a chance to meet or talk to, you know, like Alex Fitzgerald. I mean, this guy's a rock star, over 3 million in the caches. Phil Hellmuth, Andrew Brokus, Jennifer Harmon, Craig Raymer. It's been cool. It's been really, really cool.
I gotta agree, Steve. It's been fun. Well, I'll do this as long as, probably for 6 months. But anyway,
I'll get 6 more months out of you.
I don't know, Steve. What have you learned here? What do we know more about poker than we did? Well, you used to play a lot more poker probably 3 or 4 years ago when we started started the podcast, right?
I did. I think I played a little more before I started the podcast. This last year I racked up, it was either 600 or 700 hours, something like that. I think prior years I was usually over 1,000. So, the podcast does take up a lot of time, and now I am doing, other stuff too. I got promoted at work, and so that eats up a little bit more time, but, I love it just as much now as I did, when I first started in 03 at, it's just a fascinating game. It's so much fun. It's like mental war. I love the gambling aspect of it. I love taking little edges. It's just, I love the game. I love the game. It's fun.
But, so which of our guests here, who's the worst guest we've had, Steve? What? Not to get, did you hear Gavin Smith died?
Oh, no, I didn't.
50 years old.
Really? You were mentioning the worst guest, and now I'm going to feel like a total asshole.
It was so acrimonious from the start, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. It had to be us. I guess we just got off on the wrong foot. I don't know. I thought our jokes were funny. He did not. Well, that's sad to hear about that.
Yeah, it's terrible. He had a couple of kids. Too young. Carlos and I are talking. This isn't a good incentive to lose some weight, or at least a prime example of what happens when you're overweight.
Yeah. I'm even further through that book. I started adjusting my diet, actually.
Okay.
I'm not full vegan, but what I am doing is I'm putting in about a third to half of the meat per meal that I used to, and adding more vegetables.
Okay.
And, I feel good. I haven't like gained or lost any weight really, but I do feel better. I've noticed that after the meal, I'm feeling just more energetic, less lethargic, and kind of less like bloated.
Okay.
I like it. I like it. That was a good recommendation.
Yeah, I've stuck with it. I had my first piece of meat in over 2 months. I just couldn't take it anymore. I went to In-N-Out Burger.
Okay.
That was my.
You got to cheat every now and then. I mean, you're only human.
Well, no, no, no. That could. I guess if you cheat once, the thought is you just go over. But I think I'm going to be okay with this diet. But
the way I look at it is like what Tim Ferriss said in 4-Hour Body is set aside one day a week where you just go nuts and you eat whatever you want, and then it puts you back on track for the other six. I mean, if you're doing that 6 out of 7 days, that's pretty damn good.
Yep. You know? I'm almost down to my weight bet here. I'm down to 202 pounds or something, so I have to lose 2 pounds over the next, whatever that is, 6 days.
Good for you. Good for you. You got it. Well done, sir. Well done. Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at myself in the mirror this morning after the shower, and I'm like, I like doing these weights. I might have to start consciously incorporating more cardio, though, because I've noticed since I've started doing the weights that I'm only doing cardio about twice a week instead of 3 or 4. And my lungs aren't quite as strong, you know, but I feel really strong. I feel lean. I have to stretch a lot more doing the weights, so that's kind of what's cutting into the cardio. I think I need to do a cardio session and then stretch after that, which would extend one of my workouts a couple times a week, but that's not a big deal. I'll just need to do it. But, yeah, I feel good. I feel good.
I just want to look good naked, Steve. I don't care if I feel good. I don't care if I get searing intestinal pain. I want to get laid this year.
Yes. How'd the women treat you?
I'm sorry, what was that?
How are the women treating you? You still on Bumble and...
Yeah, I've got a date set up for this weekend, actually.
Nice.
We'll see how that goes.
Good deal. Where'd you meet her? On one of the apps?
Online, yeah.
Cool. I have one as well.
Okay, who's your lady from?
She lives in a town about, if you guys are familiar with Southern California, Simi, probably an hour from here. So we'll see. We're going to go have lunch tomorrow. I'm starting to figure out those dating apps. It's a game, and kind of being able to weed through the ones that are on there and just want to text, or, you know, ones that actually want to go on a date. And there's kind of a skill to that. It took me like a month or so to learn, but I'm starting to get a deal.
That's a whole another aspect of pickup. The online has its own little rules and tricks, I guess, for getting noticed.
It does, yeah, it does.
Any quick pointers there? I think I remember in the game, like one of the the pointers was always show interest, but like in the trivial things, like what is going on in this picture? None of that, like, oh, you're beautiful. Tell me about your life, this and that. It's just, you know, taking.
Yeah.
Vague interest or something like that. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah. You know what? I think we're going to have to tease that one. Maybe we can talk about it after the show. Alex is ready here. So we're going to bring in, without further ado, Alex Fitzgerald. There he is. Alex Fitzgerald. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And episode 200, no less, my friend.
Oh, wow. I'm honored.
Yes. I think you're 3 ahead of us. You just posted episode 203, right?
Yeah, you're catching up pretty quick, though. I think you're about to overtake us.
I don't know. I think the only way I'm going to catch you is if you guys quit.
Steve, you're the big train coming down the tracks, knocking everyone on their ass here.
I'm that slow, steady tortoise that just keeps on going, you know? So if you take a break, it's eventually going to catch up.
Right. I appreciate that.
Right on. So how, for those of you that probably 2.5% of our audience haven't heard of you, Alex, over 3 million in caches. You've got 2 books. I've got both of them. You got a chapter in Jonathan Little's Excelling at No Limit Hold'em tournaments. Just a rock star, man. It's really cool to have you back on the show.
I appreciate that. It's really fun to be a computer geek who plays cards and to be called a rock star. So I really appreciate that, too.
You ain't gonna hear any of that shit from me anymore. I met you. Believe me. We're doing this guy the favor here. He's going to sell at least 20 books today. Okay.
I know. All right.
Somebody should be kissing the ring here.
Yes. Hey, Mike. Good to talk with you again.
Yeah. Well, you're a Myth of Poker talent. That was awesome. Your exploited play in live poker. This one's pretty cool. One of the excerpts you said out of that is basically you said that, I'm paraphrasing here, but 95% of players are losers at the game. And then this is the part that I'll quote. You said, "You're not playing well until everyone is making fun of you. If everyone sees your game and approves of it, that means you've gained the approval of losers." Oh, that is so true. It just goes into, you know, I think we all kind of feel it is, you know, not having to worry about what other people think of you at the table.
Mm-hmm. Which is very difficult because ostracism used to mean we were going to get killed in primitive societies. So I don't think we're naturally equipped to want to be kicked out or to be made fun of at the table. But unfortunately, by the way, on that 95% number, I did get to ask a couple of gaming companies. Obviously, no poker site will publicly say, "Hey, come to our site, 95% of you will lose." But privately, a few people told me, yeah, it is around 85 to 95%. Something I've learned since then is a lot of those people are, just to clarify that number, a lot of that 95% number are people who will play 1 to 3 times and then just quit. So at your average card room, maybe 60, 70% of those guys will be losing players with the significant rake and tipping and everything, right? But it still goes to show that the majority of people are not making money at this game. So if you're escaping their notice, that means you're playing in a way that they approve of, which probably is not a good sign. And that took me a really long time to figure out. So I think it's actually a good thing if people are making fun of you, especially if you're being a little too aggressive. That means they're kind of trying to drag you back down to their level. But I don't think we talk about that enough. And it can feel really uncomfortable when you do go play and everybody's saying like, "Hey, why are you 3-betting so much?" Or, "Hey, why do you bet these weird big amounts?" and things like that.
Yeah. It, also, killing it on TPE. You've got over 40 videos. I've watched all of them, most of them more than once. I really like that hand history review that you did. The moments of humor spiked in. You said something, "Oh, what the hell are you doing here? You think you're Daniel Negreanu from 2008?
I really... wish I had a memory of that, but yeah.
Well, that's the best part, is it's just off the cuff and you don't even know you're doing it, you know?
Right. I'm going to record a few more of those videos today. I found some time to do that, but yeah, that's also, I hope everybody watches those videos knows it is in jest. It's just, that's how I talk to myself to get me to remember things. Because if you're actually really buddy-buddy with yourself, I think you get a little too comfortable with doing things incorrectly. Whereas if you inject humor, but you try to attach it to a visual that is very vivid in your mind of, "Oh, gee, I shouldn't do that," I find it's much less likely you'll do it again. So I hope the kid who was brave enough to give me 800 of his hands to review, I hope he realizes that's all in jest and he's very brave to have put his his hand history out there to be analyzed.
No. I mean, I've done a couple of coaching sessions with you and it was little moments like that that, you know, sparked it. And it's appreciated.
Yeah. Live poker.
Yes, sir.
The difference between live and online, I'd just be curious. The biggest difference is obviously exploitive versus, I mean, how would you, well, what is this book about? It's about using exploitive play properly?
Yeah, I think, and just to be clear, I've never, I did barely make an APT and a WPT final table, but I'd never call myself like a great live poker talent, but I did play a lot of cash for years. And the thing I noticed that I did better than a friend of mine who I had a buddy who played poker. I wasn't even in his zip code. Like I was dinking around in the sandbox while he was off in the stars as far as poker. But what he kept doing is he kept playing Beethoven to a cow when he played live. And the thing about live poker is because you see so few hands, it's much less likely a guy's going to improve. If you're playing on PokerStars.com every day, those players are very talented, and you're going to either get cleaned out or you're going to have to get better. So you'll notice people who play in very tough markets getting better very rapidly, whereas live poker in the United States, I really do not think has gotten better in the last 8 years. There are patches of the United States where people have gotten significantly better, primarily some games in Las Vegas, Los Angeles. Definitely people have gotten better, but there's other places where, especially newer markets, people play pretty suboptimally, and they're very unlikely to get better because you just don't see that many hands. A really good example of exploitative play that would work really well in live poker is if you ever watch the really good players on TV, you'll notice they're really careful about what they value bet on the river, in also just going for too thin a value, because if you're playing some cyborg from Germany, it's really likely he's going to turn third pair into a bluff or something like that on the river. But the average guy in Tunica or Choctaw or Portland, when he is looking at his third pair, he's thinking, this is a pair. I want this pair to be good. Should I call with this pair? And versus those people, you should be very liberally value betting on the river, even though if you were playing against a good player, they could exploit that. The chances are in live poker, just because it's so hard to get exposure to a number of hands, it's very unlikely that those players from markets that are not seeing a ton of really exceptional poker play are likely to have developed that gear to turn second pair into a bluff or something along those lines. So an exploitative play you could do is just very thinly value betting, because the bank is open with most live poker players. They'll give you 10, 15 big blinds on the river, which is your win rate for an hour, but you can't exploit others without becoming exploitable yourself. So that might not be something you want to carry out to 5-10 or 10-20 or even in a Poker Stars 109s or something along those lines. So I guess that would be the biggest difference I see between live and online, is you can get away with a few things you probably couldn't get away with much better players online who are seeing a number of hands.
Do you, when you are playing live, I don't know if you do this, you kind of, I know how much you're a mathematical guy, and you made all every software, you know, I mean, that's what the Myth of Poker Talent's all about. Mm-hmm. Do you kind of create a HUD, some of these players, when you're playing live, like, oh, this, you know, to...
Yeah.
Which your range should be in certain situations?
I've tried that very unsuccessfully. I've tried to make spreadsheets to do that a few times, but really good question, by the way. I think the best thing you can do, Mike, if you really want to like really kick someone's ass, is pay attention to what they open, because most of those, you don't need to use CardRunner's EV, Flopzilla, and a HUD a ton to see the 90% of the gains you're going to get from that. And the one thing you will see repeatedly is if a guy opens too many hands and he's not four betting back, it is extremely difficult for him to defend, especially if you're three betting large amounts. So the big thing you want to look at, you don't need a HUD, but what you need to take note of when you're playing live is if a guy opens wider than like a 15% range. So a 15% range, it would be the pairs, the really good suited connectors and stuff like that. But if you see a Jack 10 offsuit, well, that just opens up a wide variety of hands now. Like that's 12 combos of Jack 10, 12 combos of Queen Jack. If you see an Ace 4 offsuit get opened, sometimes a guy will open Ace 4 offsuit from the hijack, and I'll see that hand and I'll just, I have to keep my eyes from bulging out of my head because, oh my God, this is a big deal, because now every Ace 2, 12 combos, Ace 3, Ace 4, Ace 5, Ace 6, Ace 7, Ace 8, Ace 9 is there. That's a lot of hands that are going to miss if you three bet and the guy folds pre-flop, you make money. If you three bet and the guy gets stubborn and he calls, you're going to know what flops to c-bet as well. Like if the flop comes with two cards, nine or higher, well, most people raise with their high cards. He's probably all over that. But if it's just one high card, most of the time he's missed. Because most people, especially live, get very stubborn when you three bet them. It's like a law in the United States. You're not allowed to fold to a three bet, so everybody calls. So you can get away with a lot of those. I guess the other thing if you're trying to develop a live hut is if a guy checks back a top pair, middle pair routinely, that makes his C betting range on the flop very polarized, because if he's not betting his pairs, what is he betting? He's betting nothing, and he's betting two pair better. And unfortunately for him, there's a lot more nothing than there is two pair better. So now
he's
he's
a check raise dude.
Yeah, exactly. You can just go after that. And trying to think of what else you could look for.
Just quickly, I was thinking, but sometimes the live play, I heard some, I don't know if you've, how good a statistics you keep, or if you think this is accurate. I heard like live play, your ROI should be double what it is online, because the play, just to give, to go to your initial point, how the play is just worse. Right to you.
That sounds a little optimistic, but it definitely, okay. If you're really focusing, I think that's definitely possible.
Just again, to the idea of their opening wide, I'm sure this is just, I'm on the bad side of variance here. I'm down like 70K in live tournaments 2 years. So this is why I have but I've noticed, you know, you see the guy, the first hand open King seven off, you see someone over limp. You're kind of, you've been watching this for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, well, I'm going to start squeezing big. Like somebody limps, somebody else limps, you know, you make it five big blinds. Mm-hmm. And they both fall, regardless of what they have. And then then your ace four suited, you know, has to give up on a certain board.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the next time you see him, it's, you know, min raise, call, another call, and then you bomb it to 15 bigs, and somehow they all call.
Yeah.
I mean, that anyways, in live poker, that's the first thing I noticed, that people just really want to see flops and just will pay to do it.
It sounds like an awesome game. How many people are going to a flop? Are you just getting like three or four people to call you? So now you got.
Well, I mean, this is hypothetical. This is something I might see in like 2-3 cash. Like I'm going to put more hours at that level. Not really, but previously, I'm just like, that seemed to be with all the limping and, you know, squeezing, and I'm just like, they just don't fold. He's like, well, what's the answer to that? Just play it.
The answer I always found, which is, this is going to send your variance to hell, but it did work for me, was I would take the raise size I would recommend. Let's say you got a bunch of limpers. I think that was one of the tables you suggested, that that can be really difficult, because you isolate to an amount that you think, okay, this indicates I have a really strong hand, and half the table calls you and it's a,
yes.
Damn it. now I've got to hit something, right? That's called keno, when you got to hit something, right? But so you'll have amazing years in those games, and then you'll have terrible years when you're just missing. And the only thing I found which really helps is you take like 4x. So you start with 4x, and then you add 2x for each limper, and you just count the big blind as a limper. So one thing I'll notice is, like, say there's like two limpers. Well, the average raise will be like 5x, right? Now, the thing is, that looks like a big raise to you and I, but Joe Schmo, the plumber who watches Long Island Hustle or whatever, like, I don't think that looks that big of a raise. So he's going to call with his sixes, and that starts everybody calling. So I would go to like 8x, or so you would count the big blind and the two limpers as each limper and go 2x on them. So 6x plus 4x, so I go to 10x. And then you can even keep scaling it up in tournaments when you have, if you're in tournament play with a bunch of limpers, you don't have to go as big, because obviously the sizes are, the stack sizes are a little different. But the idea is to get one guy to call you. And usually the way you're going to get one guy to call you is you have to make a raise that is preposterous to the average person. So if it's 100x stacks and you go up to like 10x, maybe you could even go up to 15x, because an average like decent player is going to think, well, I can't set mine now with my sevens with 100 big blind stacks, so I'm going to fold. But if a guy does call you, the guy who limp calls 15x is going to be the worst player at the table. Now you're playing a 30x stack in position with the worst player at the table, which generally that is going to go very well for you. And if everybody folds, I used to be really worried about raising too big, because if everybody folded, it made me feel like I was doing nothing. But then one day it occurred to me, well, that's like 4 or 5x every time I did it. So if I did that 3 times in an hour, that was my win rate. And then eventually one guy would get really pissed off and decide he's going to slow you down. And yeah, generally there are games where people just won't fold and it goes to 15x to 20. Then now you have to go up to 20x or something like that. And then there are times I'm squeezing to amounts like 30, 35x when there's a small raise and a bunch of callers. If you're taking notes of guys, going back to like creating a live HUD, you should always take note if anybody ever like smooth calls with queens or ace king. But let's say, you know, Tweedledee opens and then three guys call. There's sometimes I'm squeezing to 35x, and if everybody folds, okay, well that's like 10, 12x. That's great. And if one guy calls, it's usually, you know, Joe Schmo, who's really angry at you, and he's going to call with ace nine suited to slow you down. And I got to shove whatever the flop comes out there, which I'm not really excited about. And there's nights I lose 4 buy-ins in 2 hours and nobody at the table likes you. But it does tend to work on – if you keep playing big pots in position against the worst player at the table, you will make money at Null'em and Hold'em. But, yeah, it does get very sickening, the variance, and it really – it's very rattling the more you deal with it.
Yeah, well, I'm probably do it like you do a lot. I come out of the tournament and I'm immediately like, this sounds like you're just making people worry about their stack right away.
Right, that's all you can really do.
And and the check raising and like the check raise this and 3-bet this, and it's like, if it doesn't work, then it's always painful when it doesn't work.
Right.
Of course, the rebuy is common everywhere too, so I don't know. But how much that affects, if the WSOP, it might be a different sort of thing when you have people who've flown 1,000 miles to get there to Vegas for the first time.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. Re-entry, you think, causes people to just play a little bit more eclectic?
Well, let's just put it this way. I mean, like some of the advice you get, I'm sure, can be even like regional. Like when you said Tunica.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Thing.
Like bluffing in LA is just not a great idea.
No, but a lot of people can make money at poker. It's just the most boring thing you've ever done in your life, which is nut peddling. I admit I thrash bums. I would never call myself a great poker player, but it's a lot of winning where nobody folds. Just out of curiosity, I had one client. She only plays his ace. She only plays aces, kings, and queens, and jacks, and she made a little money, not a ton of money, but it's a lot of it is nut peddling and raising to the biggest amounts you can. And eventually, because people are so strange, they just want to punish you. But yeah, when there's a re-entry in the tournament, I think if you could put a bow on anything, I was lucky enough to talk to a guy who got to number one in the Pocket Five's rankings, and that's the other side of the spectrum, which is online tournaments, really good players, yada yada. And the one of the things we really agreed on is multi-way pots are death, because multi-way pots, you must hit something. Even if you're in a multi-way pot with two guys, and both of them are missing 50% of the time, both of them are only missing about a third of the time, if that. So any c-bet bluff is not really going to work, so you got to hit something. So you'll be playing these big pots with maybe suboptimal players, which means you'll have one amazing year, but then you'll have two mediocre years if you're playing these multi-way pots. So, but if you can play a ton, and this is why I used to play 16 tables of just like really bad cash games on really bad networks. If you can play a ton and you just raise to these big ass amounts, that get, you'll pick up a lot of like 5x, 6x, 7x pots. Those do add up over time. And then when somebody does call you, it's usually a really bad player. The only problem is when you're playing live, like 12 hours is like 400 hands. That's, if you're lucky, that's 300 hands.
If you got a shuffling machine.
I'm sorry?
If you have a shuffling machine.
Yeah, if you're lucky, right? And if you're at the Rio, it's like 18 hands, right? Because everybody's got to stare at each other and adjust their hoodie. But it's, I mean, it's really infuriating when you're playing live because, how many hands do you really get to play a year? You can run extremely bad just given how variance is.
Position, big pot, superior hands, heads up.
Yes, sir.
It's the last one right there. Get him heads up.
Yes, sir. I mean, it's pretty much, if you're going to play your big pots in position with slightly better hands than your competition, you will do better. It's just, then it becomes a matter of, I tell all my students this, it's like, in the long run, you'll be dead. Like, you're never going to see the long run. I've seen databases. I mean, this is kind of sad. It's not really a great sales pitch, but I've seen databases of online hands where, like, it's literally the equivalent of 800 years at the WSOP, start to finish. You play every Milliman Hold'em event, and that guy's run 70% under expectation. So it's when people tell me, hey, this guy's got a great WSOP career over 9 years, and, of course, publicly, I'll say, oh, yeah, good for him. But privately, I'm thinking, what does that mean? It is really frustrating with live poker how few hands you can get in. So it does become very difficult.
When researching this book, was there kind of like research, like you had to go one of your podcasts, I remember you talking about your admiration for Phil Hellmuth, his exploitive game, I think. I mean, is it just thinking about this, is it like a new appreciation for these kind of live players that we always like a lot of us would say Phil Hellmuth would get torn apart playing America's Card Room. Like those 100. Yeah, right. Because it's just none of that shit works. You know what I mean?
Right. Raise, folding, 7X.
Yeah, live, I think, I don't know if you want to just go deeper philosophically. Sure. Well, the good exploitative player.
Well, one of the things, one of the plays that I really adore is, let's say you're at like a really tough table and everybody's really good, or let's just say this has happened to me. I was at a table in 2016. It was a PCA 5K, and I'd finished third in this tournament like a couple years prior, right? I looked around with 50 people and I went, I got to be the worst player here. They were all like 25, 50 Russian guys, right? And I was, the only edge I could find is for some reason these guys would call with like any two cards out of the big blind, because I guess your firstborn child gets taken away now if you fold the big blind. And now everybody with the big blind ante, the thing is your big blind does reduce your investment. In a tournament, in cash games too, but the big blind ante is not part of your investment out of the big blind. It doesn't reduce your investment. Like if I make it 4X and you call out of the big blind, yeah, you're only calling 3X and you get a better pot odds price than the button. But just because you contributed the big blind ante, not that that was a part of this tournament, but this is just expanding a little bit more on the big raises. Just because you contributed the big blind ante, it doesn't reduce the price you put into the pot. Like, it didn't change the pot odds price that you need to call there. But people call very liberally. Very, very good players, outstanding players, will call with 35, 40% of their hands from the big blind, will call a 4X raise. They'll go, oh, this guy must have a pretty big hand here. I better be careful on the flop, and then just check fold when they miss. You cannot make money doing that. There is no proof that that is profitable. And I can't remember what I remembered in that 2016 tournament, but looking back, I think what I remembered was Phil Hellmuth at his WSOPE tournament final table, his WSOPE main event win, he was raising to 4X and whatnot, and everybody was just folding, giving him the blinds and antes, and then the big blind would call, and then they'd fold a little too much, and he just stampeded over that final table. And I did really have a lot of admiration for that play, because I remember he was getting made fun of quite a bit for doing that, but to him it was just like, this works, I don't care. And the only thing that I think a lot of guys try to play perfect when they play, Bob Tewksbury, this mental coach, has a thing called perfect primal and prayer, which is when people compete, they play in one of three different ways. Prayer is just you hope for the best. That's dead money. Perfect is what most people are doing, which is the cutoff opens, they three bet tens on the button, and then a guy who hasn't done anything for 2 hours shoves from the big blind, and they have like 40 big blinds to start, and they just call off their chips because they're trying to play perfect. And when they go talk to their buddies, they go like, I three bet with tens with less than 40 big blinds. What was I supposed to do? That's trying to play perfect, and that creates very big mistakes, which is you're playing to not get made fun of by your friends. Primal is just, I will do anything it takes to win this tournament. I do not care. Right. And Phil Hellmuth is very primal when he plays. He does not care about what I have never spoken to him in person. I don't know who he is in person, but just as somebody who appreciates poker, like even some of his bullying tactics, I actually think are pretty smart too, because when he does it in televised tournaments, what happens is they record him getting bad beats. And what do you see is just him losing with aces, kings, or queens over and over. So you're going to think he's a much nittier player than who he is if you watch that WSOPE final table. And I bet there's a lot of mental games going on there. And it's a very primal way to play poker. And it's very fascinating from my perspective.
Yeah, he probably really has a good instinct for how the other players view him.
Yeah,
the ones who think he's a total nit, and the ones who think he's always being tricky here. You
know? Right. Yeah, he's probably got it right.
Yeah. I didn't really look at your book, so I don't know. But why don't we? I mean, is this just talking about how to adjust in terms of frequency of three betting? I mean, do you get into the stuff, the kind of Elwood, like looking for physical tells kind of stuff, or starting conversations to find out like where they're from? I mean, is there any of that kind of stuff in this book?
I do not have 10% of the reading ability that Zachary Elwood has. I've been reading his book recently, and it's just absolutely fascinating, or his books. Yeah. I do talk about the few things that really work for me there, but let's hit on tells and three betting. I beat three betting to death in this book. And I always, I admit that I push three betting probably more than I should. I fetishize it. I talk about it way more. But the reason is I think at this point in poker, in live poker, it's become very socially acceptable to open anything you want. I'll never forget Carlos Welch telling me, you know, and everybody told me, oh, he's such a nit. And then he goes, okay, so I opened Jack 9 suited under the gun, and my jaw just fell open, because when I started, I was the super aggressive kid because I opened Jack 9 suited under the gun. What the hell is wrong with you? You're supposed to be opening ace jack minimum. I mean, when you're feeling frisky, you open ace jack offsuit under the gun. Ace queen offsuit is what you should open. And if someone three bets you, don't go broke with a queen in your hand. We're in a totally different era of poker where a guy can open king two of diamonds under the gun and nobody blinks an eye. So if you just look for the guys that are opening a lot and you three bet them and they don't play back and shoot, you're just going to make more money than you deserve to make in no limit hold'em tournaments, because you'll be playing big pots in position with hopefully slightly better hands, or hands that play really well post-flop, versus guys who are not that tricky. Now, if you took it, I beat three betting to death, because I know most people will not go from three betting 8% of their hands to like 18 or 20. They'll go from 8 to 12%, but that 12% will put them in the driver's seat much more, and they'll start winning much more hold'em tournaments. Now, there is a way to overdo it, but in my experience, almost nobody gets to that point, because in live poker, if you start three betting, I three bet more than anybody I know. And if you want everybody at the table to want to open fire on you, that is the way to do it. Just three bet every single time somebody opens. But most people will not do that. The other thing about live tells, I do talk about in the tournament, one of the big edges you can get, I do talk about in the book, one of the big edges you can get is just showing up at the tournament early. And when people give their ID to the dealer, just eyeballing it, you can find out what part of the country they're from or if they're from a foreign country.
Although I did that before the main event. Yeah.
Nice, nice. What was the weirdest place you saw?
Well, there was just two guys from the Midwest who immediately think, you know, like, what, you know, Iowa and Indiana.
Yeah.
So you immediately think they're going to be kind of passive, I guess.
Yeah, more casual, right? Because poker's, yeah. Whereas if the guy's from LA, like, just hope, you know, hope to God you live, right? If he's to your left. But yeah, there's that kind of stuff. The one that's really interesting to me is baseline behavior, which is a lot of guys, some guys are just nervous all the time. And some guys are just cool, calm, and collected all the time. And you're not going to get a read off of them. And you know, maybe somebody can, but I can't. But there are guys who they're very cool, calm, and collected with a hand because they're just waiting to see if they're going to get a fatter paycheck. And then they're actually a little bit more tense when they don't have a hand. And then there's vice versa. I've played with very good players who get really excited with a hand. And then when they're running a bluff, they've just done it so many times, they don't really care. So one of the things I look for when I play is just how does a guy look when he has a hand? And I wouldn't say I'm the best at it. I think there's other people who are better at – I know one of my buddies is really good at looking at their neck and just seeing their blood pressure and stuff like that. I can't really see that, but – you can win some big pots even with a remedial understanding of this. I was at WPT Montreal, and there was a kid who just looked bored out of his mind every time he had a big hand. And he triple barreled against me, and I had second pair. And I would fold there 9 times out of 10 on the river. I might not have even called the turn, but he just looked really tense. And I went, okay, and I called, and he had jack high. So I do discuss stuff like that in the book quite a bit as well.
Although I disagree with the pulse thing. Again, this is on the side of variance. I know a couple of calls I've made where the guy's pulse is just going bananas.
Yeah, and he's excited.
Yeah, it's just
terrible at that.
or they could actually, there was one tournament where I'm like, this guy looks nervous. And then, you know, you shove all in and he has queens. He was nervous. He runs into kings,
One of the first tournaments I went deep in was APPT Manila, and I opened jacks from under the gun, and a guy who'd been really quiet the whole day 3-bet me, and I still to this day don't know if he did this on purpose or not, but he 3-bet me, and I was really thinking about folding. I looked up, and he did the most subtle, like, swallow I'd ever seen. Like, if you didn't have your eyes pierced looking for it, you wouldn't have seen it. And I was like, oh, wow, he's really tense. And then I shoved into aces. I was like, yep, I paid for that lesson. And I was out of that tournament pretty quick.
Right? GG, sir. Yeah. GG.
Yeah, yeah.
I know online from watching one of your series, I don't know if you still do this, you were very big. I think you used random.com or whatever it was, you know, changing your timing. Yeah. Make sure you don't give a timing tell. So you did. Do you do that? Any stuff of that online? I mean, live. Like, I know the one thing. This is probably pretty common. I guess try to give a false tell is if you flop a set, to always act really quickly.
Yeah.
Like whether it's call a C bet or raise, like you're just throwing out chips. Like, you know,
that's the aggressive.
Where normally a person with a set likes to sit there. What should I do here? You know.
Right.
You try to give false tells like that.
I don't know. I was using the randomizer a lot more back during the Twitch days just because there were so many more people watching me play. These days, I probably, if I were playing online, I'd probably just count to the same number on the time bank every single time.
That's what I do.
I usually know what I want to do pretty quick, but live, oh yeah, you can definitely play with that. I think what you're discussing is an awesome play versus good players because generally, when people call really quick, it really caps their range. It shows they didn't need to think about it. So one that you'll see high-stakes players do all the time is the board comes like 9 of diamonds, 7 of diamonds, 5 of spades, and they've got a set of fives. Well, the other guy's bets into them, and they just call really quickly. And that's really good to do against the, like, good but not great player because the good, not great player is going to go, oh, he capped his range there. Because if he had a set, he would have to think about raising there. So I really think he's got one pair now. So the turn comes a king, the river comes a jack, and the good but not great player triple barrels off all of his chips, right? Now that's a super dangerous play to slow play with the fives there. But the really, really good player, he trusts his physical reads and whatnot, so he can get away with it. But yeah, there's definitely the timing tell I get off of a lot of people is I've picked off a lot of bluffs because I find people kind of need to get their nerve up when they – I guess the best example I could ever give of it is if you ever jumped off of a cliff like 35 feet into water, you probably didn't hang out there looking over the edge that long. You kind of psyched yourself up and did it. And yeah. I think that's how bluffing feels like to a lot of people, because lying to someone's face for a financial – loss or gain is very disconcerting to the average person. So it's kind of like a, okay, I bet this, right? Whereas if the guy hem and haws for 2 minutes and then raises, it's a lot of the times it's like what you're talking about, Mike. It's,
he's just got it.
Yeah, he's feigning, weakness quite a bit there. And the other thing you can do with that is something I do versus good tournament players is, yeah, with a set, you're talking about the sizing. Let's say there's a flusher out there. Again, let's say it's like 9-7-5 and I hit the fives. The guy c-bets, and just the second it's on me, I'll look at the dealer and wave my hand and go, I'm all in. And the first guy will go, I call. Just yes. Get table the fours. It's like, all right. Let's go. But it does look like a flush draw, or how I used to play a flush draw, or like Jack 10 or something like that. I mean, to be fair to that guy, that is how a lot of people shove their draws. So maybe calling with the fours is a little too much, but they should certainly be thinking about it with a nine or eight. Whereas if you hem and haw for 2 minutes and then you jam, that's not how the vast majority of the public would play a draw.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. The guy's got tens there, and he doesn't even think. He's just right.
It's always the same call too, right?
You just shove 4x pot. Call.
I call. Slam the hand down. That's my favorite. Stand up. Slam the hand down like it's the gauntlet. Yeah.
Well, I still got the set, sir. Oh, that's great. Going back to three betting, I remember when you and I did our session, you really harped on that, three betting a lot, and then specifically going just a little bit more than 3X and doing the same with the three bets. As I get closer to like around the money bubble and, kind of deeper in the tournament once you're in the money and then on the final table, how do you adjust that 3X, or do you just keep firing 3.1X every time?
It's obviously, I can see how if you're operating with 40X stacks, that 3X can feel a little bit too much. To be honest, I usually keep firing it. I target a little bit more precisely, which is I really got to know the guy's opening pretty wide. So at the beginning of the tournament, when I have 100X, if a guy opens the hijack, I'm just three betting because I got a lot of chips to play with, and most guys open the hijack way too much. If I've got 40X and we're at the final table and the guy opens the hijack, I'm not just willy-nilly three betting there. Because obviously if you three bet 3X, the guy calls you c-bet and he jams on you, now you're in quite a disadvantageous position. So yeah. You can also go to 2.8X or 2.75. Okay. A little bit more here. The one thing I can say, I did write a book about poker technology, but I would never claim to be great with it. I just felt like, hey, I got to get whatever edges I can get. So I should look into this. The big thing that I got from playing with CardRunners EV and a bunch of other programs was if you raise anyone, like if you raise someone's big blind 2.5X or 2X, or if you three bet someone 2.5X or 2X, it is spellbinding how wide people can play, call versus you and still make a profit. Whereas I found in a lot of simulations, if you made it 2.8X or 3X or 3.2X and a person was calling you and they didn't have the plan to check raise you very often or to donk lead into you or something along those lines. Then I think, then I noticed many times that those people were not showing a profit. So I have increased my raise sizes a bit, and it has helped my cash rate and whatnot.
Okay. I kind of continued that. And then there are moments, like let's say we're in the cutoff and the button and the small blind both have reshift stacks. Like we've got 25 bigs and they've got 10 and 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big blind has 25 like us. In those spots, I don't like to do the 3X as much. Sometimes I'll do like 2.2.
Oh, when you're opening? Oh, yeah, definitely. Because if the only – the big thing is to not get 3-bet. If you get the big blind to call you or everybody to fold, you're going to make money. But it's if you're going to get 3-bet, that's when you're going to lose money. Playing defense, if you look on your database and you look at the times you get 3-bet, chances are it's really difficult for you to make money. But if people are just going to jam or fold, yeah, by all means, just open a 2X or 2.2X or whatever you think will facilitate them folding more and not 3-betting that much or you not losing that much when they do 3-bet.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, just to go back to the frequency of 3-betting, just playing cash, I mean, this would go to arguing in favor of your strategy here. There's this one guy there who just 3-bets so wide. You know, there's kind of against the nitty sort of day crews when he's there. You'll see him show down queen three off, and I mean just about everything, and still nobody there is 4-bet bluffing.
Right.
I've done it a couple times where now he knows, like sure. I'm a pro, and he's not going to screw with me nearly as much as everyone else. Everybody else is just when I get a hand, I'm going to punish this bastard. You know what I mean, kind of thing. And you know, obviously he's a winning player. He's smart, even though he's
yeah.
If he plays like that against a bunch of pros, he's going to get torn to pieces, of course.
Right. But, it works there. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, this is probably like the early stage, a lot of live tournaments. Like if you start 3-bet squeezing a lot, they're just like, oh, I'm going to drill this guy in the ass, but I get aces. They're just waiting for the big game.
Well, I think a great way to think about 3-betting is just imagine a poker game where there was a sensor on your cards. And when they noticed your hand was in the top 30% of the hands, a second big blind just came out there when it was folded to you. Well, you would expect people to raise your second big blind pretty liberally because 30% of the hands is still a pretty awful range. But when you 3-bet people, it's almost like a social faux pas. Like, how dare you? Right? And yet, people, it's really awesome that you're 4-betting because that's the only defense against it. And you actually, something I talk about in the book is what I call the nuclear strategy, which is, I read a book called Command and Control, and it was just about, it was by the same guy who did Fast Food Nation. Long story short, they talk very little about the strategy of nuclear arms. And the big idea is if you have the willingness to fire it at any time, you'll never have to fire it, is what they hope for. And with the 4-bet, you've shown the guy, I'll fire this at any time. Now, he doesn't know you don't want to do that normally. He just thinks, well, Mike's coming, right? if I 3-bet here. So he doesn't do it to you anymore, right? Even though you might have burned a stack once or twice. Do I have that right?
I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't 3-bet you anymore? Oh, that was smart.
No, he still 3-bets. But even though I've narrowed my opening range against him when he's, got the button or whatever.
Right.
He's not going to go after me as much as everyone else.
Right, which is a
he does have, big. He does drink a lot and have ego and like, you know, he likes being the boss there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
With me anyways.
Yeah. But I like that you've turned yourself into a guy he can't really do that with just any two cards versus.
Yeah, cash versus tournaments. I don't know if I do this all the time in cash, and it's kind of it's not really manipulative. People deserve a lot of people want to go there and feel like, especially when they're playing against good players, want to feel like they've made a right play, whether they've lost the hand. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. So I do this a lot. I don't know if I could reckon, but for those Cash Game Live, if somebody is just bluffing way too often, and there's easy calls for you, like on the river, I'll take some time and go, man, I know you got bottom set on me.
That's smart.
So I'm going to call, but they think that their bluffing is putting me in tough spots.
Right.
You're allowing them to save face. I know. Yes.
So I do the same thing with the opposite, obviously, with the nits, the people you're just never paying off.
Right.
You bluffing me with six high again? Or, you know what I mean? Even though I've been playing with 2 years, you know, there's
still. That's smart. No, that's it. That's next level stuff, because there was a guy I knew who was just an incredible poker player. And long story short, I can't remember if he saw me snap call somebody when I picked up a tell or something, or he heard about this. And I just got drilled, because he was like, well, he'll never do that again, will he? And not only that, it's really bad in the long term for you, because you pretty much just told the guy you have his tell, or you know how he plays and whatnot. He might change up how he plays the next time. You're not going to know, and you're going to be behind the eight ball for the first 6 hours in that session, where if you do hem and haw and you do allow him to save face, more likely than not, you're going to get to keep exploiting him in that fashion. So, yeah, I really like how you do that.
Yeah, I learned that lesson a few years ago when I snap called a guy with a weak ace. And to me, it was blatantly obvious that my hand was good, so why take my time? And then when he sheepishly threw his cards away, I was all, oh, God, you just told the fish at the table. That was bad. You know? That's what the light bulb went on.
You've got to allow
these recreational players to save face and think they're playing well. You know?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but something I wanted to say to your credit is, now you're thinking like a card player. You can always tell a guy's not a real card player at the WSOP, because he rubs there was a guy, actually this was in Montreal, he was an amazing poker player, but there was a girl to my left who made a very tight fold against me, and I obviously it wasn't a good play, but I told her, like, you know, I said something to the effect of, like, yeah, maybe I had it there. And the guy just rubbed her nose in it, right? And told, you know, this guy's working you. And it was like, well, there you go, buddy. Now we can't bluff her anymore. But, oh, everybody gets to know how smart you are now. Like, well done. You know, whereas if the guy who's, like, he's got two houses and he takes – are the real high stakes card player, the guys who play 25-50, much more gentlemanly, much more quiet. Like, could you ever see Chip Reese or Doyle Brunson doing that? Just rubbing someone's nose in it? No, they're going to hem and haw. They're going to ask after your family, et cetera. That's providing more of a service as opposed to just humiliating people.
Exactly. Yeah.
Another thing, I don't, like, again, I don't, if this sort of thing you get in the book is if you can tell this is just my personality, right? Right away, I have people who are like, really think I'm funny and want to hear me talk. And then there's other people who just hate me almost on sight. Like, this can be, like, if you're looking for an overbet spot and, like, let's say online, you know, the typical, you're looking at a specific spot against a guy, you know, knows you're a pro and has to defend his range, so-and-so. And you can, like, overbet a river because you checked back a turn, make look like you missed a draw or whatever. Where I feel like there's overbet spots I can take in live where the guy doesn't like me.
Right, right.
He just, like, I can tell just by the way he looks at me or talks to me. So, I mean, I don't know if you have any experiences like that where you're playing against certain guys because, you know.
That's a damn good point. That should have made it into the book, but I didn't have it nearly as much. I do talk about, well, there's certain perceptions that I think are pretty much givens in poker, which is if you're over the age of 50 and you raise to big amounts, they're just going to assume you have it every single time. If you're in your 20s and you're a white male, they're going to think you don't have it most of the time. But yeah, you do have to pay attention to how people talk to you and realize I guess I don't talk as much at live tables, so I haven't been thinking about that lately. But yeah, there are times like guys will say little remarks and whatnot, and you know the guy hates you, and it's just hilarious when, you know, you fire your set on the river and the guy has to call you with fourth pair or whatever, right? But it's no, that is definitely really important. It's funny how polarizing talking at the table can be, right? Like just trying to enjoy your time at work will just infuriate some people, like as if you're just supposed to stay there like an automaton the entire time and have your headphones in. It's really good that you pay attention to that.
Yeah, I try to anyways. What was the other question I have? Steve, you can step into the breach here if you have anything to say.
Well, do you have a hard out, Alex, or?
No hands, Steve, for God's sakes, no hands yet.
Okay, what's Steve doing?
We have this asset here to learn more about poker. I'm not sure, but, what else should we talk? Is there any other part of the book you think we're missing here that you talk about in live play?
No, there's, I guess the big thing that I'm teaching, the thing that I'm really love teaching right now is low and mid stakes, because I find I can help those people the most. Whereas once you get into high stakes, what's going to help you is going to change so much every month that it's really hard to write a book about it. The thing that's been helping a lot of my students lately is obviously we talk about like play your bigger pots in position, try to be leading on the pot. But the other thing I've been teaching guys is, hey, when you know the guy's got a wide range, my buddy the other day was showing me one of the GTO solvers. It's the one on Card Runner's EV. And we were trying out big bets. And we found, you know, if a guy's got a tight range, do not bet big. That's not a good idea. If the guy has very disciplined opening ranges and flatting your three bet ranges and whatnot. But if you're playing live in the United States and you got one of these guys that's opening a lot, calling a lot out of the position, or is calling from the big blind pretty wide, it looked like the big bets were pretty good. And the thing I think that is, the reason for that is no limit hold'em is not a game that was made to be balanced. If you buy a game for your PlayStation 4 right now, one of these blockbuster titles, there were 100 people in a boardroom 9 months of the last year making sure that game was perfectly calibrated. No Limit Hold'em was made by a bunch of Texas gamblers that got sick of dealing 7th Street out on 7-card stud. They just got bored and they put the 5 cards in the middle. It is not an airtight game. It's broken. And one of the ways it's broken is any bet that is seen as really big right now will generally get people to fold their high cards on the flop. So if a guy calls you with 35% of the hands out of position, or a guy opens 25% of the hands from the low jack and then calls every three bet with pretty much all of them, what on the flop, on average, they're going to miss 45 to 55% of the time. And you're going to know exactly what boards they miss. It's generally, they like to do that with high cards. There's more combos of king-jack offsuit than there are of pocket sixes or 8-7 suited, for example. So if the board comes with 2 cards 9 or higher, generally that guy's much more over that board, so you should take your free cards. But if the board only has 1 high card, if the board has no high cards, if you bet 75% of the pot, that needs to work 42.8% of the time, but chances are that guy does not have a pair or a draw 50% of the time. So your bet is going to turn a profit. And the next thing that's really been helping my students, backtracking just a bit, on the ace high board, they will have a lot of pairs, obviously, because the ace is the
just
most
popular pot. Okay. Yeah.
So maybe just bet a third pot on those boards, because the guy's either got an ace or he doesn't, right? But yeah.
I was just going to say, again, like obviously in live play, you're trying to adjust not to just generally, you know, live play quotations, but the specific table you're on. So just anecdotally, and again, this might be just me running into the top of the range and running bad, and there's like, you know, not a huge sample, but like your view is obviously that players will overfold, and this is why it's good to squeeze and blast. And I feel just like people are overcalling, like,
right.
The old guys are floating on me on the ace high to see what I do on the turn. And maybe this is just, I'm getting tougher tables, but like just how I feel where the live game is right now. I'm playing, I think, Nidhi are trying to punish people with, for value, because I just think they're calling down bluffs too often for that kind of side. You know.
Mike, you make a damn good point, which is I'm probably a little biased here, and I'm probably not seeing the full picture in that I normally just – I play poker tournaments because, honestly, I think the average 2-5 player could thrash most great tournament regulars. Yes. And I play a lot of – but when I do play cash games, it's like 1-3 in Pittsburgh, right? Like not that many Rhodes Scholars in those games. Whereas I think – where are you playing out of?
I play Southern California.
Yeah, so Southern California might be the worst place in the United States to play cash game poker. That is my honest belief. That is Las Vegas, I honestly think, is better, because you'll find tougher games in Las Vegas, but you'll also find a lot of – I don't think the best players in the world are playing at the Orleans 1-2. But
you can also find the softest games, I think, as well, you know?
Yeah.
Just in terms of, I guess, just – again, if I had to, 4 years ago, I mean, I guess this would be arguing that either I've taken a step back as a tournament player or the fields have gotten tougher.
Right.
But I just feel like a few years ago, I would have said my average table, I got one guy who's maybe a little bit better, and two guys are at my level, and I got five people I have a clear edge on.
Right.
Where now I felt like this summer, it's like, okay, there's like six guys who are basically the same as me here or better.
Right.
There's only two chumps in the field, but I don't. Again, that might just be variance.
No, I think you're right. A few of my buddies made a lot of their money from Southern California, and they've just left. They have left because they say they said the exact same thing. I'm not going to say the specific rooms because then I might expose who they are. But they said the same thing, which was they used to have a lot of just average guys coming in and punting, and then the games were so. I don't know where you're playing. What city specifically are you playing?
Oceanside.
Oceanside. Yeah. Okay. So that's better. But like there were sometimes I was playing in LA. I thought people were going to like pull guns out over a $300 pot. That doesn't make the average guy feel comfortable, but it will allow a grifter to feel comfortable, in which case, unfortunately, grifters are a little bit better at cards because it's a hustling game. So now I don't know anything about your card room, but it sounds like from what I've heard in Southern California, the games have just gotten tougher and tougher recently. And yeah, that can be very true because there's a very simple strategy you can play, which is if you can get people heads up and they fold their high cards, you will just be making small pot after small pot after small pot. And then when they call you, it's very easy. You just trust they have a pair. And know that most guys are not really good at folding pairs. So you can value bet if you want, but probably shouldn't bluff too often unless the board is absolutely horrendous for their pair. But you're right. If people are calling you with high cards to float you and raise you on the turn because they think you're double barreling a little too wide, all bets are off. This is that's high level stuff. That is I don't.
Well, your book is not trying to convince people to play live poker. It's just explaining how to be better at it. But I was just throwing out my general view that, and of course, a lot of people say this. People who played poker 10 years ago, who were playing making $150 an hour, are now have to play well to make half that. And
right, you know, really, exactly.
Yeah, but anyway, like in a 1500, I'm now play 2-5 with an 800 cap, but I used to play 5-5 with a 1500 cap, and I would say in the 1500 cap. There was, on average, the pros almost always 85% of the time outnumbered the amateurs.
Right, that's not good.
And of course, if you're playing pros even, then you're still making money. But now at 2-5, it's probably there's only two pros at the table. So that's,
No, it's
less,
brutal.
Less money at the table, but it makes playing poker certainly easier.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what I wanted to say before, by the way, when you were just talking about image at the table. I remember the first time I met you. Maybe you're surprised how old I was. You're like, dude, you got to get some golf hats. Sit at the table. He's like, your ROI would double. I mean, you're kind of making a joke too, but you're just saying, just look like a guy who's came into town to fuck around,
No, because you
know, that's not a bad idea.
Mike, you can pass for being younger too. So you got to play up that you're older, right? Like I was being serious because Has anyone under the age of 30, any white male, showed up with a Titleist hat in Oakley sunglasses at the Venetian? It hasn't happened. But if you wear that, oh, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, weekend warrior, right? And then when you're three betting them wide and when you're going after them, I don't think they're going to anticipate that as much. I stand behind that. Get that Titleist hat.
That's great. Oh, so true. Titleist hat, clean haircut, and a polo shirt with the glasses.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is poker pros underdress when they show up at the table because mm-hmm. it's another day at the office, or maybe they want to subtly impress upon others that this isn't much of anything. Recreational players dress up. They get ready, right? And they wear their favorite poker gear or whatever, like check out my three bet shirt or whatever, right? So I think if you can affect that, that's really good. But the only tournament I ever won in Vegas, I actually dressed up for, and it was spooky how much more my three bets work. They were like, all right, dumbass, trust fund baby, I'm glad you got queens again. But yeah, if I was sitting there in my beanie and a black t-shirt, I don't know if that would have worked as much. I feel like people want to punish you more at that point. Like, who the hell are you to think you could beat me in a poker pot? You can't even dress yourself.
Right. Steve, we did it backwards, but I want to know what Alex is up to these days.
We did. I'm so excited about the book and everything. But yeah, so what? You're out in New York now, right?
Yes, sir.
How's that working out? How do you like it?
I love New York, man. Like, this is it's a high just being here every day. There's just so much going on. I was living in Costa Rica before, and in the New York metropolitan area, there are five times as many people in this city than there are in the entirety of Costa Rica as a nation. It is, there's just always something going on. I love that about this city.
That's cool. I'm going to be out there for St. Paddy's Day.
Oh, for real, man. Hit me up.
I'm going to march in the tournament, I'm just thinking poker right now. March in the parade.
Nice.
I'll have to hit you up when I get out there. I'll have you instead of Clayton Fletcher.
Oh, that'd be great, man. Awesome.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I got to see the Natural History Museum, too. I've been out to New York probably five times and spent an entire day there each time.
I know. It's incredible, right? The museums the people don't talk about the museums here, but you can just learn about damn near anything here. And they have like free museum week here. And there's hours where there's not many people, or if you can get like a Tuesday off, it's just, it's amazing.
That's cool. I'm excited.
In terms of doing, new material, I'm just curious with this book, is it like, do you have like a goal, like every 6 months I have to do a webinar, I mean, just to pay the bills or sell a book, or is this, do you get excited with the new project, or it's like, okay, it's time to make some money doing something else? You know what I mean? I mean, and this isn't a criticism.
Oh, hell yeah, I get it. No, for real, I get what you're saying. Hell yeah, I get excited just because every time I do it, you don't really know what you know until you put it down on paper. There's sometimes I'm writing something, I go, wait a second, that makes no sense, right? Or you show it to your buddy and go, isn't this cool? And they go, this makes no sense. Look at this. Damn it. But once you get it on paper and you have, I'm really lucky to have some students that are just amazing poker players. And once they go, oh yeah, that really holds weight. Or I never put it in those words, but I do that. Then you just feel like a much better player. And that gives you so much more confidence when you go out to Atlantic City, when you go to Baltimore, when you go to Montreal, or whatnot. So I haven't been making as many new products as I'd like. I do have one that I've been working quite a bit on that I'm not really sure why haven't I gotten it published or whatever. But yeah, it is, it's fun just to find how you can simplify it more, how you can teach it better. And a lot of that comes from, it's not really, okay, time to pay the bills. It's okay, every 6 months of teaching every single day, I just get better at teaching certain things. Because the 34th time you teach something, you go, oh, you know what would be an easier way to explain this? If I said this instead of that. And then you it's like a live testing ground, because my students then will go out and try it. And if they get improved results, you know, it works. Whereas I really worry when you're teaching and you haven't been able to test it on anyone. I'm probably going to try to play a little bit more. I was trying to get my, as I came back to the United States, just kind of get my affairs in order a little bit more and have just everything together more financially. So I was doing more of the work on the side, but I am going to, I got to play 5 live tournaments this year, which was really fun, but I'm hoping to play more in the next year probably after about April.
So you still love the game and you still like helping other people get better at it. Still a great job for you.
It's an awesome, it's really fun getting to help like Granny to kick ass at like the Laughlin poker tables and stuff like that. It's really fun. My newest market that I really love is just senior citizens. And I love them because one, they, at that age, you stop caring what other people think. So if I'm doing something stupid, they'll just tell me. Or if something doesn't make sense, they'll just tell me. And two, it's really fun to help someone who you normally wouldn't think of as a shark at the table, like just kick some ass, right? But yeah, that's, I focus more on that market now because it's far more rewarding. And I also do some, I guess you'd call them passion projects, just helping out kids in third world countries, not kids, but like adults that maybe wouldn't have as much money for poker coaching as normal. Because that stuff gets me really motivated and it really makes me want to go out there and play again, which is obviously awesome because I'm sure you know this, Mike. You can burn out on poker very easily if you are not cultivating the love for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We just had Andrew Brokus on. I'm sorry to jump off to, but before I asked him this question, which I thought was interesting, and I'll tell you his answer. I said, "Is there anyone you kind of you start coaching and you know they're just never going to get better, and you have to tell them that?" And he said, "Because you're the same. Your coaching is not cheap,
right?
Comparatively to a lot of people." So I was wondering, Andrew has a thing where he has people answer a questionnaire beforehand. And he's probably only taking the people who take the game seriously. You know what I mean? Or have some people he thinks he can help. So he already knows what he's dealing with. But I was just curious of that. You say you like helping Granny better, but have you ever thought, oof, Granny should do something else?
That's a really good question. One, I do have a questionnaire now when I talk to people. I also don't teach pretty much. Well, I'm doing more with the info products now than I am with teaching. So I am very selective about who I take on. I always took a poker player not improving as evidence of my failure as a coach. And if someone was willing to learn and I couldn't teach them, my opinion was personally that I failed. And okay. I took that really personally, and I blame myself. So what I found is there are some people who, and I can sympathize because when I listen to Phil Galfond talk, I think, what the hell is this guy talking about, right? And or Matthew Janda, I read his books and I'm like, I've highlighted this passage. I've reread it 5 times. I still have no idea what the hell it means.
Yeah, I only made 20 pages of that into that book. And I'm like, this is so bad.
It's brutal, man. But, you know, it takes me so long to understand things. And there are friends of mine who I can tell them once and then they'll make a point I've never thought of. And I get pissed off at just how much computational power they have. But so I can sympathize. There are people that I recognize cannot do combinatorics in their mind. That is not a skill every single person have. The thing that I try to tell myself that's very humbling is usually these people have something else they can do which I could not even fathom, right? What be it driving a race car or whatever it is. And the other thing is I should have an algorithm they can apply that will help them make money. Now, will I get them to 25-50 in playing super high rollers? Absolutely not. And I'll even tell them that in the first few lessons. But I can get them beating 1-3 if they're in a softer market. I can get them beating $20 MTTs. I can get them beating $50 MTTs in a softer market. But
even if you take someone who's been losing a shitload of money playing tournaments into a break-even player, they've made a lot of money.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I said, even if you help someone who's a massive loser into breaking even, they're saying right. they've made a lot of money by really, you know, now they have down they have money for other things.
Yeah, the thing that I think I used to lose sight of is this is entertainment for a lot of people, and a lot of people have a lot of money from whatever else they do, and they don't really give a rat's ass about learning the game. They just don't want to lose their ass off. And if you can get them, you're right, if you can get them to break even, that's a really big deal. There are people I cannot improve, but every single time it has been an attitude problem. I have fired a number of clients because of their attitude. And just because it's not
going to ask you about that. Yeah. You said there was one stable that was hired you as a coach to help their losing players. And they all thought they were all running bad and knew all the answers.
Yeah. There was a long time ago, right? I've been really lucky that the stables that I've worked with, most of them have been amazing. Like, the people at Pokar, for example, are just, I don't work with them anymore in any capacity. Just to be clear about that, but I never had anything but positive experiences with them, and all their kids were just amazing. But yeah, there was there was one time I got some like really low stakes kids who were, you know, everything was I'm God's gift to poker. I can't believe this is happening to me, and I you know, it's really hard to tell them like, hey, buddy, if you can't beat $10 tournaments in your local like lottery ticket market, I think this one's on you, right? And then they just don't want to hear it, in which case you're not going to learn what you don't want to hear. I can't do anything at that point, right? And I've had to return a backer's money because it's like, look, it would be very humorous for me to listen to this kid whine for 5 hours and to take your money, but I don't want the reputation that's going to come from that. So I've just unfortunately had to cut ties in those situations.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. How are you and your lady doing these days, man?
Yeah, we're doing awesome, man. Just
Steve, are you friends with Alex on Facebook? Have you seen pictures of his woman?
Yeah, he and I both have similar tastes in women. We like them
Stuff, you know, I was just thinking, the first time I saw a Facebook photo of the two, I'm like, oh, wow, she's cute, you know, nice looking couple. The next time I'm like, she's really cute. How did this guy pull this off? And now I'm like, Jesus, this woman's beautiful. How does a fucking bozo like this achieve this? But maybe you can offer some women advice to me, which is always a problem for me.
I got you bounced
back fast, man. That's impressive.
I'm very fortunate, which is we actually went to high school together, so we've known each other for a long time. So it wasn't I don't know how much there was on my part. I'm also very lucky that she's a very good woman, and I think I just had to be myself, which is I think I'm naturally a giver when it comes to life, and perhaps not creating boundaries when I should have before.
Yeah. Give me something I can use.
Yeah, I'm letting you know I'm not the guy to talk to, man. No. I'm just stupidly lucky. I'm just,
so this wasn't
because
like,
as you know, huh?
I thought this might be the girl that you were just loved and obsessed in high school that didn't pay attention, and you know, the second you got divorced.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Let's give this a try.
No, I mean, I'll let you know. I honestly just I couldn't really tell you. I think there comes a time if you're lucky and you can be your authentic self, someone will recognize that. But like, as you know, when it comes to dating, there's times you can be a very giving person and just be worked over. And I couldn't tell you. I think I just got very lucky to meet someone who accepts me for me and also has known me for a really long time and has hopefully seen that I do try to progress. But I'm not the guy to talk to about that, man. You're going to have to read, what's his name? Who's that guy who's the big blogger now in New York City? Mark Manson. He's the one everybody talks about when it comes to that stuff.
Do you have to be, it looks like you're out a lot and, you know, doing fun stuff. Is that like, you're kind of an introvert too, though. I mean, there's probably a lot of times you want to just be home watching a Mariners game.
Yeah, right? Or, yeah. No, I, yeah. I have a rule. I have to fall asleep in front of a Mariners game like six nights of the week. That's where I get my thinking. I've gone to that age where I'm an old enough white man. I fall asleep with my arms crossed in front of the TV. And if someone
you just had a birthday, right? What are you, 31?
31, yes, sir. And
what were you doing? Were you popping bottles?
Hell no. I went to the Manny I went and watched the Manny Pacquiao fight on CCTV, no, in a local theater. But yeah, I know I'm really interesting, right? It's I'm a pretty boring dude. I'm not gonna lie. I do. That's the awesome thing about New York, though, is it's like a vacation that never ends. You can take the subway line three different places, and you'll be here's Coney Island, and here's a botanical garden, and here's an old Buddhist monastery, and here's a zoo, and here's where the New York Yankees play, and it's.
Here's a poker player pushing a mule cart down Fifth Avenue trying to sell books.
poker for sale. Yeah, I really think getting out is, I mean, just from a workaholic perspective, you think about an athlete. Let's use boxing because we were just talking about the Manny Pacquiao fight. When that guy gets into his corner, he's not tense up and like shuffling back and forth. It's all, he's loose. They're massaging down his shoulders, breathing very deep, eyes closed. For years, I just screwed up my productivity because on my days off, I didn't take a 2-day weekend for 9.5 years of my 20s because I'm an idiot. And I'm getting way more done in New York because this is my lady's influence. This is not something I came up with, but the 2 days I'm off, I am off. It is like there is no Twitter, there are no emails, there is nothing. And it's just like I'm sure if athletes do not go play the game, if LeBron is sitting out for the game, he's not playing playground hoops that morning and studying game film. I bet they really want him resting as much as possible. And then when he comes back into the office, he's probably going to go really hard. And New York is just the perfect place for that because there's something new to do every weekend here.
Hey, Steve, do you notice I asked about his lady and pretty soon we're talking about LeBron James? I mean, he's very dark. I'm sorry if you feel ambushed, homie. All I did is, you know, ask how you – I didn't ask you to send me naked pics or anything.
segue right into that, yeah.
Now I know better, Steve. This is a sign of probably true love. He doesn't want to, you know, talk about his lady.
It's one of those things, like, if we're talking about me, we can make fun of me as much as possible because that's fine. But or we can talk a bit. It's weird when you're talking about someone else because you just want to make sure, okay, should I say that? Should I do that? And I worry about the fluidity of the interview. So I guess if there is an out, I take it. But you're right. You're completely right. You called me out on it. You got it.
Right on. Well, How do you guys feel? Do you guys want to? It sounds like Mike wants.
The other question is just what do you have targeted for live tournaments since we're talking about live poker this year? Anything?
Oh yeah, will you be out at the WSOP?
No, that's a good question. The WSOP. I like going in at the end because everybody's just ragged and playing like crap. So it's really nice to just be spry and awake. But I'm not as into Montreal as I was. Montreal was an amazing market and it was really easy to get to from New York for a while. But they're just getting better and better the more I'm up there. And I think that's the exposure to PokerStars.com. And I think if you just grow up near a card room or you're near a card room and you're very excited playing every day and online poker, the .coms are set up, you're probably going to go out to it. So Baltimore, very soft games. I've heard really good things about the DC area and just based on how good Baltimore is and that proximity, I'm probably going to be out there more. Not really looking at Florida or LA, probably just a lot of Vegas, a lot of the East Coast, things like that. Atlantic City, I think, has five events this year or something along those lines. Like Borgata is really ratcheting it up. And I was lucky enough to go deep in a recent event at Borgata, and that was just a blast. There still are quite a few places to make money in Atlantic City. The players are better. I'm not going to act like it's like playing in a newer market. There are guys who can play the game there very well. And one kid whooped my ass in a couple pots deep in the tournament. But for the most part, I really like that market. And the fun part about Atlantic City is I literally take one subway and then I get out at the station. I walk like two flights of stairs down and I get into a $20 bus and I'm in Atlantic City that night and are in 2 or 3 hours. So I'm really looking at that. And they're about to get their own arena football team. So of course I got to get out there, but yeah, looking at a lot of Atlantic City.
Nice. Yeah. I like the Borgata. Big guarantee, it's awesome. big guarantees. And they have even like that massive room where they have the tournaments there. I don't know. It's fun, but yeah.
It's amazing. Have you ever walked around Atlantic City though, dude? Like just out of curiosity to see the city?
Not real. I've once stayed at a woman's house that was a couple of miles, you know, from there.
Oh, yeah.
And she was, you know, buying a house in Atlantic City is probably pretty cheap because it's so it's got a lot of dangerous, got a lot of urban problems, you know.
It looks like a bomb went off when you go through these cities. It's mind-blowing. I always try to walk through the city because it's like, you know, not everybody gets to travel, right? So it's like, you should go walk around. I've never really felt that uncomfortable in a lot of places in the United States. They kind of oversell how dangerous a lot of places are. Atlantic City, I don't know if they're overselling. Like, there were a few places I was walking around. I was like, I got to get the hell out of here, man. This is bad. Like, and then, it's kind of, it's fun to go there, but you really hope to see the city get redeveloped. And, yeah, I think you're right about housing prices. I think they've come down.
Yeah, I think there's always these economic studies at which point they want to do. But, I remember when they were talking about getting a new casino in Connecticut. The people who were against it came up with all these studies that basically, well, yes, there'll be 5,000 new jobs, but there'll be also, you know, this from all the gambling addicts, there'll be this much homeless. So it attracts the drug addicts too. There'll be, you know, basically all the urban blight that a casino causes.
Yeah. Well, it's the problem that happened with Atlantic City is that used to be the only place in the East Coast you could gamble. And now you can go to Foxwoods, you can go to,
right. Yep.
You can go to Washington, D.C., you can go to Philadelphia. I haven't been to Philly yet, but I really want to get out there. I've heard the games are good there too, but yeah, it's just,
I've been there. They're good.
Oh, they're good. You've been out there?
Yeah. This was about 10 years ago, but it was, I'm assuming they're about the same, but yeah, it was super soaked.
Yeah. My buddy says he loves it out there, but yeah, going back to the topic at hand, I guess that did got Atlantic City, but yeah. Anyways, I'll be going out to that bombed out city, hopefully a few times this year, and hopefully we'll be taking some money home from the war zone.
Run in with your black jacket and run out.
Yeah. Walk around with a cloak.
Yes. I've got my cloaking device. I should be safe. That's cool. You briefly mentioned
the economic opportunity, these tournaments, or is there part of the ego of you that, you know, I want to be on the fucking ESPN sometime here? You know, I mean, you had a little, of course, that with the EPT years ago.
Yeah. You know, obviously that'd be really fun, but it's really hard to word this without, I just stopped caring as much. I'm not really sure why. I really love the thrill of getting deep in tournaments. Like when I was deep at the WPT in Atlantic City, that was like, oh my God, that was a rush. And it was just, it's so fun to like go into these towns and it feels like a bygone era, right? Like everything's on the computer now and everything's, the thing I hate the most about my job is just being at my computer all day. And, but just to like, you know, you take the Greyhound in and you go into the Days Inn and you like prep for war and you go in, it's so visceral and real, like being at the live table. And it's analog in a digital world and you're still staring people down and trying to pick them off, right? I get so into that it was actually, we were at the final 30 of that tournament. That was about as far as I got. It hit me, hey, you might be at this final table. And there was a part of me like, I don't want to be at that TV table, right? I don't want to, being on camera, I just, it's disconcerting to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm just shy or something, but I just love playing tournament poker. So I guess that does get me beyond that. But the ego thing, I don't know. It's like, is winning a poker tournament really a sign you're a good poker player? We've seen a lot of jackasses win poker tournaments that weren't that good, right? So it's...
Thanks, buddy. Oh, you weren't necessarily talking about me.
No, but I've won a poker tournament before. Maybe I can't play. But yeah, I think it's a cool thing to have for yourself, but I think it's got to be for yourself, because I think you stop looking at the money once you start thinking about the press. There was during one of the AC tournaments I was deciding to go to, there was a poker series in Buffalo. And when I heard that, by the way, the greatest choice you've ever gotten to make in your life, do I want to go to Atlantic City or Buffalo, New York? Like, wow, the places you'll go in this industry. But it was all a dream when I was a kid. I made it. But when I found out about the Buffalo series, I was honestly kind of pissed that I didn't go out to it, because honestly, where are all the pros going to be there? They're going to be in Atlantic City because they'll say it's for the money, but your ROI might be better in Buffalo because there's not going to be a single reg there. Right. And that maybe should have been where I was being. But when I was talking with guys about that, the guys I know who are in this for the money, they got it pretty quick, or they're in it for the competition and the money. But when you're out for the fame, I think that can really lead you. And this happened to me too when I was starting. It just wasn't good enough for me to play at Planet Hollywood. I had to play the Bellagio Cup, damn it. And now looking back, you know, it's when you play the Bellagio Cup, it's just you and nine guys who are all pretty, or eight guys who are all pretty damn good at poker. Whereas if you head out to even rooms that are supposed to be tougher, like the Venetian, you'll still see a lot of punters out there. And I think that's where you want to be, even if there isn't TV time involved.
Are you looking for any seedy Newark home games there? Were you a fan of The Sopranos?
I watched the first season, and for some reason, I loved the first season, and then I just got busy and I didn't keep watching it. But no,
there's quite a bit of stuff that goes on. That's like one of their moneymakers, having these little private games. And there's one where somebody gets killed in one of these, another one where there's always shit going down. But well, I was just thinking that could be a chapter in your good book. Not that I want you to get held up in Newark, but you know.
Well, I was at a home game once in Seattle where some guy was acting a little out of hand, and I don't want to act like I knew something was going to happen, but I was just tired, and I was like, this is awkward. I'm getting out of here. And I left. Well, apparently that guy decided to pull a shotgun on the whole game. And after that, I was like, yeah, you know, I don't really want to make that call to my disabled mother one day. Like, hey, I'm paralyzed because I had to go to this home game. Don't know.
I flopped a double gutter and I wanted to see if I couldn't get, I couldn't leave when the shot started firing.
Right. Hey, hold on. Come on. Rabbit hunt. But yeah. No, I get really squeamish about a lot of home games, but I guess in the Jersey area it would be different. By the way, I'm in Queens now. I'm not in Newark anymore, but Newark. But did manage to move that far up in the world. But I've been invited out to a few home games that seem a little bit more fun in New York. I do hope to get into that a little bit more in 2019. It's just the next 6 to 10 weeks are always really busy because everybody needs to get their poker lessons before the WSOP or Scoop and all that. So it's probably going to be a few months.
Pretty cool.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Steve. I'm working. If I've done bad this interview, I'll just give the, I've I'm up on 4 hours sleep here again. So
it's all good. It's all good.
You know, I'm rambling quite a bit.
These are awesome questions. No, man. The poker questions and the personal questions were fine, but even if I'm not the best at them, but the poker questions were awesome. This was a really fun interview. It's sometimes you keep getting the same questions, which are fine because you want to help people, right? But you had really like the ones that made me think like that's actually probably a missing chapter in the book, just being more aware of your image and using timing tells against people and stuff. That's the more advanced stuff that I don't always get to talk about. So that was really fun.
Yeah.
Steve, I was thinking, you know, they have all this technology, like in movies now, they can do young versions of characters, you know, with their face. Like there's technology where we could give answers with Alex's voice. I don't like him avoiding my question with his woman. So we can just edit it. Saying, oh yeah, she's great. So it's her cousin. I banged her last week too. Put stuff like that in there and just, you know, create a controversy.
If you guys want to freak yourself out, I think they're called deep fakes. Look it up. It's coming where they're going to be able to record you talking for 20 minutes and they're going to be able to simulate all your affectations and your vocabulary choice and make it so you could say what Mike just said right now, which I don't want to say too loudly. There's my girl in the other room.
Hopefully we can get that.
Talk about technology that can be misused. Steve would be behind bars on kitty rape within like 2 weeks. So just I couldn't fight the temptation.
Yeah, it would be too funny, right? That the world is headed for a very scary time. I've been reading too much about it. Just the AI stuff and the deep fakes and the blockchain is very fascinating too, but yeah. Anyway, not to derail this.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That's good. Stevie, can we ready to wrap this up here?
Yes, sir.
Episode 200, or do we have anything? Are we singing a song? I hope not.
Unless you had one plan.
No, I've been begging you for 2 years now to have an episode with no goddamn strategy. I hope this is the one, but.
Well, I think you got it, Mikey. I think you got it. I had a hand ready, but this was a lot more interesting.
This was fun, like
a theory-based, very cool. If you guys want to get a hold of Alex for coaching or some of his products, you can go to our website, headsuppoker.poker, click under the Circle of Trust tab, and he'll be right under there with all his contacts and how to get a hold of him. His book, his older book, The Myth of Poker Talent, and his new book about exploiting live poker is, we'll throw a link in the show notes, and you got it on Audible, you got a paperback. That's very cool. The Audible is key, dude. Well done.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on. This was really fun.
Yeah, this was a blast. And thank you for tuning in. Here is your weekly motivational speech.
So why is it, come February, we're back doing the same old shit, making the same mistakes, hanging around with the same old people, doing the same bad habits, making the same excuses? This happens every single year, and I'm telling you now, if you don't want to fall into the same old trap that you do every year, then you need to change something else before all that other shit that you put on your resolution list. You need to change your mind. You need to change the way you think, the way you look at the world, the way you look at problems. You've got to change what you believe is possible. Without the correct mindset and belief about what you're capable of or what you will have, you'll have no chance of following through on any of your New Year's resolutions. This year will be the same as last year if you don't change your mind. This will be your year. Don't let what's happened to you up until this point define what happens from this point on. All the shit that you've been through in life, all the pain, all the darkness. You have the power to change it from this day forward, but you have to change your mind.